Extreme weather isn't our only environmental challenge. What do you know about hypoxia?
If we don't sustain our natural resources to produce both future natural resources and sustain human activities, then we're not making very wise decisions.
A MacArthur Grant recipient is documenting the ocean's dead zones and what happens if we don't take action. Plus, the question of reaching urban kids and learning gun safety. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. According to a 2008 study, there are over 400 dead zones in waters all over the globe. They are spots where increased nutrients have resulted in hypoxia, low oxygen, and can no longer sustain the organisms that once lived there. The vast majority of them are along the U.S. East Coast and Gulf Coast, with one area as large as 27,000 miles across. This year, marine ecologist Nancy Rabelais was one of the winners of the MacArthur Genius Grants. She directs the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, and for almost 30 years has led the program collecting basic data on seasonal oxygen levels and nutrients in Gulf waters. I spoke with Rabelais after her award and asked her to explain what hypoxia is, what it does, and what it means.
It means low oxygen. It means insufficient oxygen for most marine life as we know it, fish, shrimp, crabs, muds, you know, worms that live in the mud, brill stars, snails, clams, not to be able to live if the oxygen falls below a certain value. It's a combination of both physics and biology. The physics is a stratification from fresher water or warmer water or both in the surface layer that keeps oxygen from the upper layer reaching the bottom. So that's the physics. The biology is that there are excess nutrients or nutrient stimulation of phytoplankton, which end up on the bottom as dead phytoplankton or fecal pellets, and that carbon is respired by bacteria, which use up the oxygen. And the oxygen is used up at a much faster rate than can be resupplied from the surface across that two-layer system. The effects are decrease in suitable habitat for fisheries species, both commercial, recreational, and just natural resources in general. There's a loss of biodiversity. There's a loss of biomass. There's a loss of abundance. There is a loss of mature benthic communities. There's loss in potential productivity offshore if organisms cannot migrate past the low oxygen barrier to reach a larger size for capture or even for just reproduction. So, does that answer all of that?
Well, yeah, it does. And the layman's term for it is a dead zone.
Not everything is dead, however. The low oxygen is from the middle of the water down to the bottom, so that the upper layers above that, two-layer system has enough oxygen to support fish and other things that normally live in the upper water column.
You are based on the Gulf Coast.
Yes.
So you have been in a unique position to really document what goes on in an area, not only through the business that goes on there, but then after the spill too, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The spill was quite unfortunate for fisheries in our area, mostly because the area was closed to commercial and recreational fishing for quite some time, which drove away business and caused some fisheries groups to go go bankrupt. I think this year was a little bit better than certainly 2010 and 2011, but we're still not back to the level of recreational charter fishers that we used to have in this area.
So in a sense, is what you're finding in the Gulf Coast an opportunity to show what could be impacts all over the world with various challenges to the ocean?
if we don't sustain our natural resources in some capacity to produce both future natural resources and sustain human activities, then we're not making very wise decisions.
Is there actually a way to reverse what's been done so far, or can we simply stop continuing to do what we do?
There are some areas that have had successes. This is mainly through urban wastewater treatment. However, most of the nutrient sources to the Mississippi River are from agricultural practices, so that takes a different approach and a broader society buy-in to making a difference. The northwest shelf of the Black Sea, which receives the inputs of the Danube, has the same time course as the Mississippi River, except for the ending. Nitrogen and phosphorus went up. Hypoxia got worse. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, nitrogen and phosphorus went down. And the low oxygen area decreased and finally became non-existent. So that shows the direct relationship to nitrogen and phosphorus, but achieving those reductions in a sustainable economy are much different than what happened in the Soviet Union. And, you know, nobody is recommending a collapse of the agricultural industry in the Midwest. But there are actions that can be taken on a broader scale, taken more wide scale, that could make a difference. I think one of the issues is that people think this is a middle of the U.S. versus a Gulf issue. And the middle of the U.S. has water quality problems as well, with stagnant waters and blue-green algal blooms that are toxic, nitrate levels in drinking water. And I think if the Midwest would pay attention to their own water quality and pollution problems, that would not only benefit them, but also benefit the Gulf of Mexico. So I think this should be a collaborative effort that involves the whole watershed and the coastal waters of the Gulf.
And it sounds mostly like what you're discussing are the human impacts, the industrial impacts. Do the warming temperatures and the impact of climate change have anything to do with this as well, or is this mostly human-caused?
What has happened so far is human-caused. Climate can aggravate it. The climate scenario for the Mississippi River watershed is for earlier snowmelt and more precipitation in the upper part of the watershed, which will release more water, more nutrients into the Gulf, which will aggravate the low oxygen problem. The other aspect is temperatures, and in the Gulf of Mexico, as the surface waters get warmer, the layering can be strengthened, which would prevent more oxygen from getting from the surface to the bottom, and so that would also aggravate low oxygen conditions. On the other hand, the lower Mississippi is destined for less runoff, and warmer temperatures may enforce more frequent severe tropical storms, and that does a temporary mixing of the water column, but really is not a long-term solution.
Now that you've won that MacArthur grant, what is your intention? Are you going in a new direction with your studies or just going deeper where you already are?
I think the grant itself will help make up the difference in what is now a miserable federal funding climate and help me do some things that what would normally come from grants that might not be possible anymore. Travel, support of graduate students, student travel to meetings, buying equipment, and doing some things that with my severely cut federal grant budgets will allow me to do.
Nancy Rabelais is a marine ecologist whose work on hypoxia won her one of this year's MacArthur Genius Grants. Coming up, cops, kids, and boxing, plus a personal view of the question of guns. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1221. For many students, athletic scholarships pave the way to a better future. But one sport, boxing, has long been anathema to academia. The NCAA hasn't had a boxing program since 1960, the year a boxer suffered a fatal hemorrhage during league championships. In New York City, the Police Athletic League kept kids in the ring for much longer, until 2006, when the boxing program got knocked out by budget cuts and flagging support from donors. But one organization working in Brooklyn and Staten Island is convinced that boxing is the secret to getting through to at-risk teenagers. Tom DeChristopher has the story.
To Jonathan Suazo, this is the sound of opportunity. 2 years ago, Jonathan discovered Teddy Atlas Cops and Kids, a free boxing gym in East Flatbush, Brooklyn. At the time, he weighed 270 pounds. He spent most of his time playing video games and watching movies. Today, he's a healthy 180, and he feels pretty good about himself.
You know what? Like, I came a long way. You know, I look at myself every day in the mirror just to remember who I was, you know, and why I got to keep going, you know?
Boxing got Jonathan off the couch. Now, he's hoping it will help him earn his GED and get a good job. That's because boxers don't just come to Cops and Kids to hit the bags. They also come here to hit the books.
You get 5 into 35 is 6. 5 into 30. No, 5. I'm sorry.
My name's Maria Veneer. I'm a teacher tutor here at Teddy Atlas Cops and Kids. I'm also in charge of making sure the kids are on a sound academic path as well as career path.
Maria says boxing isn't a sport known for creating student athletes, but Cops and Kids is trying to change that. The boxers here have to keep up their grades to stay in the ring. True to the spirit of boxing, Maria is tough. Just ask Jonathan.
She opens my mind, and it's in a funny way. And it's like, after I'm done with her, my head hurts. I'm like, oh my God, I have a headache now.
But Jonathan listens to Maria, perhaps because there's something special about her. Maria is a boxer. In fact, she's a New York City amateur champion.
I entered the Golden Gloves in 2002, and I ended up winning.
She's a role model in the fact that she was a boxer, who became a New York City public school teacher, which is, I think, very impressive.
Patrick Russo is the founder of Cops and Kids. He says Maria's experience in the ring helps her connect with the students. Patrick was the director of the Police Athletic League's boxing program before it lost funding in 2006. He started Cops and Kids in 2010. Patrick knew teens needed somewhere to go after school, a place where they could learn discipline and self-worth. Maria says this is key to keeping kids out of trouble.
How do you prevent crime? You open up a program where kids can come to and they have a place to go and they're developing, you know, championship attitudes, and we know that the city lacks this and we need to provide it.
Looking at the scale of the problem, it's not hard to see what Maria means. Arrests among 16 to 21-year-olds have risen sharply in low-income, mostly black neighborhoods in East Brooklyn. There were more than 2,000 arrests in the Brownsville neighborhood last year, for everything from petty theft to first-degree murder. Above the ring at the Flatbush Gym is a memorial for Trey Franklin, one of Maria's best students and a Brownsville resident. Pictures of Trey are flanked by his boxing gloves. He came up through the program and won a scholarship to Kingsborough Community College. But in July, all that Trey had worked for came to a sudden end.
He went into the Golden Gloves. He made it to the semifinals. Incredibly gifted and talented in his athletic abilities. Sweet kid, very respectful, very kind. And they murdered him in Brownsville.
Trey was shot outside a party while playing dice with friends. Months later, Maria still has trouble processing the loss. She thought she'd be tutoring Trey through college. She thought she'd watch him graduate. Now, she keeps a picture of him in her closet at school.
I put my jacket and I see him and, you know, I just say, "What's up, champ?" And, you know, and it inspires me to, like, do my job and, you know, because I guess I dedicate the next half of my my career as a teacher to him.
So far, 3 Cops and Kids boxers have won scholarships, and the program is helping other kids achieve their dreams. Nelson Rivera had 2 dreams. to join the Marines and become a pro boxer. Last fall, he came to the gym every weekday to study for the military entrance exam with Maria.
You got it? You got all the like vocabulary words and all that stuff?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a problem too.
All that hard work paid off. Nelson made it into the Marines, and he hasn't forgotten how he got there.
To Maria, I just wanted to give you this as a symbol of appreciation. Thank you for all the long hours of studying, because without you, I wouldn't even be able to wear this uniform. And that was on back of his graduation picture for the United States Marines.
There are a lot more kids who need help. The Cops and Kids staff would like to open a gym in every borough. But for now, Maria is focused on the students she has. And boxers like Nelson are keeping their eye on the prize. Tom DeChristopher, East Flatbush, Brooklyn.
And finally, many of us go our whole lives without touching a gun. Yet for thousands of Americans, they are a way of life. Reporter Mary Schell takes us to North Central Missouri, where gun ownership is the norm, to find out if and how Americans can responsibly coexist with firearms.
At the age of 29, I realized I had never held a gun. In fact, the only time I'd seen one up close was 8 years ago on the losing end of a robbery in Northwest Philadelphia. Two teenagers brandished a semi-automatic pistol in the entryway of my friend's home. They ran off with a wallet and about $30. I remember thinking their gun looked a lot nicer than the guns the cops showed up with a few minutes later. This fall, I decided it was time to confront the beast. I wanted to understand how guns work, if we really need them, and how we can safely coexist with them. So I went home to Missouri to speak with friends and family about guns. My first stop was to visit Ralph Gates and his wife Marianne, my dad's high school English teacher. Ralph, a serious collector, preferred not to tell me exactly how many guns he owns.
When we first got married, I think he had 14 guns, and that was many years ago and many boxes ago.
According to Marianne, 50% of our budget goes for defense.
Ralph's theory is that people are afraid of guns because they lack training and education.
To me, a quality firearm is like a painting hanging on a wall. It's a different kind of art. And some of the engraving and inlaying and stock fitting and beautiful choice of woods for the stocks, to me, is very artistic.
So guns can be works of art. But they are dangerous, aren't they? In 2008, the National Safety Council reported that for people ages 19 and under, there were almost 3,000 gun-related deaths. But only 100 of those were unintentional. So how do you avoid being one of the 100?
With a firearm, it's really pretty basic. You never point it at anything you don't want to shoot. You never load it until you're ready to shoot something. And that's just cut and dried and ingrained in the head of everyone that uses firearms responsibly.
Okay, so I needed to learn something about guns. And who better to teach me than my grandfather, a retired Marine and trained marksman? He agreed to show me the basics of guns and ammunition. We arrived at my grandparents' home in Holden, Missouri on a Sunday afternoon. My grandfather stood over a workbench crowded with ammunition. He carefully measured black powder onto a scale with a silver teaspoon and pressed new bullets into brass casings, one at a time.
You have case, primer, powder inside, and a bullet. It's ready to go in into the rifle and be fired now. I've loaded up 50 to take down to the range.
Rifles lined a gun rack to the left of the workbench.
And this is the rifle that we'll be shooting them out of. This is strictly a target rifle. Has a stainless steel barrel, heavy barrel. It's on a pre-1964 Winchester action.
My grandfather explained that this was a single-shot rifle. That means you have to load the gun each time you fire it. He also showed me a semi-automatic handgun, the same kind of gun I had seen 8 years ago.
It's a semi-automatic handgun, so...
It's a Sig Sauer, The caliber is 40. Smith & Wesson designed the caliber. And it came out probably maybe 15, 20 years ago. And it's more powerful than a 9mm.
Semi-automatic means you can fire the gun every time you pull the trigger for as many bullets as you've loaded into the gun. Thankfully, there were no fully automatic weapons in the mix. Not that my grandfather wouldn't have been amped about that.
I've seen them on TV. It's exciting just to watch them. They tear cars up. They blow up gasoline tanks.
Why does somebody need a fully automatic weapon?
They're fun.
We packed the guns, paper targets, and earplugs into his truck and headed to the Pioneer Gun Club, home to hundreds of members in and around the state of Missouri. The sun was setting, so we only had a couple hours to shoot. My grandfather closed the range, which flashes emergency lights and rings a school bell. This alerts other members not to shoot. He stapled paper targets up at 25 and 50 yards before ringing the bell a second time. Then he set up the first shot, sat down next to the rifle, and fired. He had the biggest smile on his face that I've ever seen. Then it was my turn. Even with the weight of the gun, lining up the shot was difficult. And nothing prepared me for the sound of that gun in my ear.
Did it surprise you?
Yeah. I tried it a couple times. Then we closed the range and marched into the fields to retrieve our paper target results.
Now this is at 50 yards, so whatever your grouping is, it's called a minute of angle.
Not terrible for the first time.
No. It's in the blood, kid. It's in the blood.
My ears were still ringing as we packed up the truck. According to Ralph and Marianne, I would need to practice a lot more to be truly safe with these weapons. I'm not there yet. But given the number of guns my family owns, I feel like I'm taking a step in the right direction. In Holden, Missouri, I'm Mary Schell.
Getting pretty close to quitting time, folks.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.